You're listening to the home of cool, irreverent, and entertaining talk right here on LA Talk Radio. You're listening to Answers for the Family with Alan Cardoza.
Alan Cardoza.
Only on LA Talk Radio.
Welcome, I'm Alan Cardoza, and you're listening to Answers for the Family. As a licensed private investigator and certified instructor in nonviolent crisis intervention, with over 30 years' experience working with families in crisis, I've been fortunate enough to meet and work with some of the top professionals in this field. I will bring you some of these incredibly talented and caring people each week as we bring you Answers for the Family. Having escorted thousands of teens to specialized schools and programs, returned hundreds of runaways, and retrieved many abducted children, I bring a unique outlook at what our kids are going through and what can be done to help them survive. And if that doesn't work, well, survive, but we want them actually to thrive. This show brings you answers and options to raising children today and in our constantly changing future. Answers for the Family will address issues such as locating your runaway teen, family crisis intervention, building self-esteem, dealing with addictions, and international parental abductions. We will introduce you to specialized schools and treatment programs that can really help, and new innovations in these areas. I'm thrilled to have as my guest today Dr. Terry Solacek. Terry is an experienced and compassionate educational consultant with nearly 30 years in the field. As a member of the Independent Educational Consultants Association, she maintains the highest standards in educational consultation. Terry works with children that have specific learning needs emotionally, academically, and behaviorally. She offers a variety of options for education that relate to specific issues a teen may have. Terry, thank you so much for being here.
Good morning, and thank you for having me.
All right. Now, to jump right in for our listeners that may not know what an educational consultant does, please share what it entails.
Educational consultants work with families of children, adolescents, and young adults in terms of exploring appropriate school programs, therapeutic programs, intervention programs. It can be anything from looking at day school options to boarding schools to, again, therapeutic and specialized learning environments that may be across the country or abroad.
That's great. Now, what advice would you give the parents, you know, the ones that have a child, and to them, they say, my child's out of control. I mean, when they come with you with something like that, how can you help them get to the right place?
Well, the first thing we do is take a thorough history so that we have a really good idea of what exactly is transpiring. We take a developmental history, a medical history, academic history, social history. One of the other things that's very important is to look at what kind of interventions have already been tried. For example, you know, has the child been in therapy? Has there been psychotherapy, family therapy, individual therapy, group therapy? Is there an assessment done on the child? Many times we'll recommend that children be tested so that we have a really good idea of what is underlying the behaviors that might be being exhibited so that we can then determine an appropriate course of action.
Well, now, speaking of testing, when is it appropriate?
Well, personally, I think it's appropriate for almost any child at any point in time. But, you know, in particular, when a child is struggling, we'll often see children in elementary schools that are struggling academically. And so one of the first things that we want to look at is there any kind of an underlying learning issue or developmental issue? If a child is struggling in middle school or high school, we still want to look at the learning because many times, especially with a child who's bright, they're able to function well in elementary school. And as you move into middle school and high school, and there is a more demand on the ability to organize and output information, that's often a good time to be assessed.
Right. Well, it sounds like what you're saying is that there's multi-levels of testing. So a child may need it academically, or on the other hand, they may need it more from a therapeutic standpoint. And at times, can you have, by doing one, you'll find out that maybe that's where the problem lies, where the parents may have thought it was the other?
Absolutely. We often find behavioral issues, attention issues, and when you really look back, there's some learning issues. The other thing, though, that we often look at is the emotional functioning. For kids, whether they have learning issues or they are learning intact, if you will, that there are underlying emotional issues that are leading to some of the behavior issues, leading to substance abuse. We see many kids with underlying depressions, anxiety disorders, and other psychological issues that really need to be addressed.
What type of tests do you use? Are they ones people would recognize? Or?
Well, they're standardized testing. It all depends on what it is you're looking for. If it's a child or an adolescent and you're looking at learning, you're often going to get one of the Wechsler scales, either the one for children or the one for adults. There's achievement testing that we do or that can be done, and as well as emotional testing. There's personality inventories. There's projective testing, the ink blots, storytelling tests. There's a variety of instruments that are out there, really dependent upon what it is that you're looking for.
That's great. Now, we've also had some questions that came in from people that sent in emails knowing that you were going to be here.
Wonderful.
We've advised through our emails that you were going to be on today. And one of them we got asks, it says, what if an adolescent gets in minor trouble legally? Will a judge suspend a sentence if the child is going to a specialized program?
Well, we've seen many of those in my office, and it's pretty much a case-by-case basis. And typically, we will speak in those kind of situations with the attorney so that we can really get an idea of what it looks like the consequences are going to be of the offense. In many cases, we find that judges like kids going into treatment because rather than strictly having punishment, whether it's community service, youth camp, or some type of program locally, that if they're really getting something more comprehensive and getting the treatment they need, that they will readily, okay it. The second piece that we like with that is it gives additional leverage for the child, especially if a court order can be written that the child successfully complete a program, and if not, what the consequence would be, rather than just having them say, okay, well, you go for 6 months and then you're done, because kids can just kind of bide their time.
Mm-hmm. I would imagine that that's probably happening more now and probably will continue more in the future with government's budgets being cut. I mean, I can envision a lot of judges saying, let me see if I understand this right. They're going to get help and they're going to be out of our jurisdiction and not part of our budget. I see that as a win-win.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
Now, a second part of that same question from the same person was, does it help if the program is far away?
I don't know that that's necessarily the main variable, but it sure hasn't, at least in my experience, it hasn't hurt.
Yeah, that was kind of my thought as well. And actually, I mean, speaking on the economy a little bit, you know, based on our economy right now, what changes have you seen in the industry?
The economy is a tough one, especially if you're talking therapeutic programs, whether they're wilderness intervention, whether they're therapeutic boarding schools, residential treatment, etc. They're all very, very expensive to begin with. And I think one of the things that we're all anticipating in the economy is how people are going to afford the programs. Many of the student loan programs are no longer giving out loans. Families were, in many cases, refinancing, and that's going to be increasingly difficult to do. School districts, county mental health, again, everyone's feeling the tightening of the budget. Mm-hmm. So my concern is that some programs aren't going to be able to make it, or that kids will be going for a shorter period of time. Kids won't be doing some of the wilderness intervention programs, for example, either at all or for shorter periods just to get them into something longer term.
Yeah, I think that's kind of my fear too, sort of as what happened many years ago with the hospital settings when some of that funding dried up. All of a sudden, the same type of work with a particular child where they might need, you know, 3 months, 6 months, 9 months to work with them, all of a sudden they're counting it in days and weeks,
right,
and thinking they can do the same thing. And,
right.
And I have that concern.
I have that concern. I also have the concern that there won't be money for aftercare, because when children do complete these programs and are either reintegrated back home or looking at step-down programs, though there's less funding available for those. So I think it's going to be pretty difficult.
And what about, I mean, do you think there's going to be more of a conversion to more of a home care situation?
You mean in terms of bringing professionals into the home?
Right, where they're going to be doing that more on a short-term basis, or like for a few hours a day type of thing, rather than because they can't afford to send them off to a particular program.
I can see that much more for younger kids. If it's an older, you know, a mid-adolescent or an older adolescent, and there's substance abuse, and they're so non-compliant, I don't know that home care is even going to be effective, because you have to be able to have some containment of the kid if you're going to try and implement anything. I mean, you see so many of the same types of kids that I do. You know, they're sneaking out at night. Parents are dropping them off at school, and they don't walk
right
in the door. A parent sets a limit and says, no, you may not go to the movies, and the child bolts out the front door. So if you don't have that kind of containment, I think a home program is going to be very difficult.
I would agree. And I know that you know, many of them need structure, you know, as far as structure setting up in the home. And when you mention aftercare, and that was the first thing I thought of, is that, you know, if they're going to a program for a shorter period of time, it sounds like that structure is going to be so much more important now to be able to deal with the aftercare.
Absolutely. And there are companies that work with aftercare and helping families to structure it. But the family has to be motivated to make the change and to do things different. And in a lot of cases, it's hard just strictly from the fact of, if you've got two parents that are working, they're siblings, it makes it very, very difficult. One of the things we talk to parents a lot about as kids are transitioning back home is that they do need the structure and the containment. And, you know, if they've been away for 6 months or 9 months or a year, they need to earn driving the car back. They need to earn the cell phones. And so often what we're talking to families about is, no, they have to have a phone and they have to be able to drive, either because they want to and we don't want to have to argue about it, or we need them to shuttle the, you know, younger siblings. We need to know where they are.
Mm-hmm.
So it makes it very hard.
Yeah, and actually it reminds me of a particular case with a family that we transported their child off to a particular program. And after, as a short-term program, the child came back, and the same thing started happening. The child ran away. We were asked to find them, took them to a different program. This time it was longer. Child came back, same type of thing. Child runs away. This went on 3 times.
Wow.
So the third time, we brought the child back, and the father says to me, he goes, I don't understand. He goes, you know, I'm paying a lot of money for these programs. Why is it that they're failing? And I said to him in his first name, it doesn't matter, but I said, what's the common denominator here? I mean, think about it. What is the common denominator of these situations? And he said, what do you mean? And I said, well, you go, you know, your child goes off to a short-term program, comes back to your home. Child goes to a longer program, comes back to your home. And after I got to the third point, he went, oh, my God, the common denominator is me.
Yep.
Thank you.
And we talk so often about that, and we tell parents that they need to work as hard, if not harder,
mm-hmm,
than the child works, because things have to change at home. You can do all kinds of interventions. If they come back to the exact same environment, you're right back to square one.
Mm-hmm. So what are some of the things that you can recommend to parents that they can do, both from the you know, from the standpoint of sticking to their guns while they're in the program, and then what they can do afterwards?
A lot of families we have go into treatment. A combination of sometimes some marital work and communication. Other times it's much more family-oriented, working with the child while they're in a program. One of the things that I think is really important if kids are in therapeutic programs is that there is a family therapy component, because these kids don't grow up in isolation. And there's a lot of work that really needs to be done. And so I think a lot of times the therapist from the program is crucial in working with the family, as well as a therapist back home. Once kids do come home for good, And my ideal is as kids begin to come home for visits, they start working with the family therapist at home, who then is in touch with the therapist in the child's program, so that you end up with as seamless a transition as you can. And family therapy is the most important part when kids come home, even more so than individual, to teach them, everyone in the family, what it's like to have Johnny home again and how things are going to change, and that it impacts not just the parents but the siblings.
Mm-hmm.
And to be able to have someone to help facilitate a behavior contract, curfews, and all of the other typical parenting things I think that we all take for granted.
Right.
But everyone is different when a child is coming back, and you need to be able to work with all of that.
Well, you mentioned a lot about the therapy component to this. I mean, tell us a little bit about the difference. And one of the things that I didn't bring up in the very beginning, but I mean, Terry is also a licensed psychologist. She is a PhD as well as an educational consultant. And how does that make your practice somewhat different?
Most consultants aren't psychologists, and sometimes I become real, I guess, egocentric because I can't imagine doing this kind of work without having the background. I think just the clinical skills really help in terms of interviewing families, really looking at what's underlying. Understanding testing, as we talked a little bit about testing earlier, I think is incredibly important. And just having the background just kind of helps you see that big picture. It helps me to determine what type of program do I want a child in.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of different types of therapeutic programs. And behaviorally, these kids may all look the same. But if you really have a clear understanding of what's underlying the behaviors, then you're able to look at, okay, what type of intervention do we need? What types of clinical services?
Okay. What would be some of the questions that parents can ask themselves to determine, do they need to see an educational consultant? What are the questions they would ask about their own family or their own children?
I think they need to have some way of getting information. Do they really know what is going on with their child? You know, has their child been tested? Is the child in therapy? Are they in family therapy? Just trying to get some external pieces of information other than just what they know as parents. And as diligent as a parent may be, what they know is only a drop in the bucket. In fact, it was very interesting. I don't know if you watched Desperate Housewives, but I was watching it last night. And a mother had a very unique way of finding out what her son was up to, by posing as a teenager, online.
Online, yeah.
And developed a relationship until it got found out. But, you know, most adolescents don't communicate really well with their parents. And as parents, we really want to try and find out. But as we begin to talk about placement, which to me is the last thing that you want to do as a parent. And as we tell parents all the time, is you have to believe that you have exhausted all of the outpatient options, meaning you've done therapy, you've had, if medication is an issue, you've done medication evals. If substance abuse is an issue, maybe having completed or at least attempted some of the outpatient substance abuse programs. But you have to feel that you've exhausted everything, because once a child gets to where they're going, we tell parents their reaction is going to be one of two things. Either, I hate you, I can't believe you did this, I'm never going to talk to you again. Or, I'm so, so sorry, Mom and Dad. I really didn't realize what I was doing. Please, please bring me home, and I promise everything will be okay. And we tell parents that when you get either one of those types of letters, you need to be able to say, I'm sorry, we love you, but you are staying. And if they aren't at that point, I will dissuade them from placing a child until they get to where they believe they've exhausted everything.
Right, and they're not going to sabotage it by folding. You
absolutely.
Know, by folding their cards and going, oh, okay, because that's probably the same way that they got to that problem to begin with.
Yep. And then you've just basically created a monster.
They've empowered them more
you can do.
Because they've shown them, oh, that same level of manipulation still works.
Yep. Yep. Your kid doesn't get, they're not cured in the first 24 hours. Yeah. I wish it was so easy.
Exactly. Don't we all? One of the things that I do want to get out to the listeners is, If there are questions, feel free to either email us at answersforthefamily.com. That's answers, the numeral for, thefamily.com. You can go on our blog. You can present questions. We'll forward them to Terry, and she can answer them. Or if you would like to call her, Terry, if you want to give your phone number.
Okay, our number is area code 818-348-8248.
That's great. And let's take a break. And as I'm clicking on it, it's not coming up. And Sam's not here. So we will continue.
We won't take a break.
We won't take a break.
That's
because
okay.
The thing I was going to press for a break just didn't work. And my apologies. I'm not real good at working this whole board thing.
But they're great at working with kids.
Now, with you mentioned a little bit earlier about the parent who posed as a teen to go on some of the social networks. And these are places like MySpace, Facebook, places like that. How much of a problem is that becoming in regards to kids who are not really gaining the socialization they need to work with us personally, you know, rather than through the internet? I mean, how big of a problem is that becoming?
We're seeing it increasingly becoming a problem as kids are isolating more. When you and I were kids, we would always be talking on the phone, and our parents would go, get off the phone, get off the phone, get off the phone, and the days prior to call waiting. I think what's happening now are kids are isolating in their rooms. Most people have their houses are wired. Kids have laptops. They have their cell phones. They're texting. They're on the social network sites. We're seeing a lot of kids on the gaming sites, and they're just doing lots and lots of internet gaming and, you know, are talking about, you know, my friends, yet you don't have the social interaction. And they're, you know, we're really beginning to see the impact on social skills as these kids are struggling to interact. The other thing, and I think schools are becoming more proactive, particularly with the social network sites, when it comes to how these kids are portraying themselves. And I encourage parents to get their kids' passwords, get on these sites so that they can at least see what their children are doing and how they are portraying themselves to the outside world.
Oh, absolutely. And we, in fact, when we've been moving certain kids, it's been interesting to me. I mean, we had one, you know, one person we were moving. And they went, no, you can't. I mean, I can't go to this program. I absolutely can't because I have plans. I'm supposed to be online tonight, and I've got 4,000 friends.
Right.
I go, do you really think you've got 4,000 friends? I said, you've got 4,000 people that happen to have joined your network, or that can click on and find out information about you. But I think we're getting a distorted view of what a friend is.
I agree.
You know, and my thing, I think, while I was moving that particular child, and I said, how many of these are the type of friend that you can call at 4 o'clock in the morning and say, you know, I'm stranded somewhere. Can you come pick me up and take me home?
Yeah. And we're seeing the same thing. In fact, we had a family. The son met some girl online, I think in Chicago or Florida or somewhere. And he talked the parents into flying out there so he could meet her. And they literally flew out there and met her.
Wow.
And it's, I don't know. You don't know what you're really dealing with. And I know I think either you've done or you're scheduling some of those internet safety kinds of shows, which I think is just increasingly important. It's also difficult because these kids are much more computer savvy than we are.
Exactly.
So they can get around the blocks. They can get around all kinds of things that we just don't have that expertise. At least I don't.
Well, yeah, and your point about being more savvy, and I just had a parent that emailed us information on what it is that they wanted to do with their child, and they said, you know, we've dealt with an ed consultant, and we want our child to go here, or whatever the situation was. The child ran away, and when we eventually found the child said, well, yeah, I took off as soon as I was reading my mom's emails because she's tapped in. She's got her mother's password. Her mother didn't know how to know what her child was doing, but the girl sure knew what the mother was doing.
I haven't seen that one. I'm not surprised. I mean, they're just so savvy. I mean, we talk to parents a lot about, you know, setting limits and protecting kids. From my standpoint, I don't think kids should have computers in their room. And everyone has a laptop. Well, you know what? 10 o'clock at night, that laptop needs to go downstairs. Same with the cell phone. Mm-hmm. Because what we're finding is these kids don't sleep. They're up all night. They're playing games. They're texting. They're online doing whatever. And then the morning comes and they can't get up to go to school. They haven't done their homework. So, you know, just as parents, we need to be more vigilant and we need to set limits.
Absolutely. And the cell phones are now smartphones.
Yep.
And if a cell phone is a smartphone, that means they can go on the internet with it. They can go on their social networks. They can pull up pretty much anything they want if you don't have any, and you probably don't have controls over it if it's their cell phone.
Right. Well, you know what? If you're paying for the cell phone and your kid's your child, you're the one who does have the control.
Exactly.
You know, the other thing that we're finding too is, you know, parents will ground their kids from the computer, but then they go use their friend's cell phone or mm-hmm. their friend's computer. So it really is hard.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I know. One of the things that that I know is an important issue to all of us, and that is the confidentiality. Now, for those that don't know, something that I can share, which is Terry handles a lot of very high profile cases. And one of the reasons why is because it's never ended up on the Inquirer or anything like that, because, you know, she understands how to do that. Now, if you can share a little bit, I mean, you know, what are some of the things that you do or that you feel needs to continue to be done to keep the confidentiality the way that you do?
I think confidentiality is important for everyone, not just high profile. And some of the things that tend to, or situations that tend to be a little frustrating, is we may have a family come in and we do whatever with their child, and then they refer a friend. And, you know, the friend says, well, you know, you sent this one somewhere, and why can't that one go this way? And not being able to discuss case by case. So that,
right.
Those are just dynamics that we have to work on, you know, within our office. As we're talking about programs, and especially therapeutic programs, there's a lot of the HIPAA regulations, which everyone goes along with, which has to do with, you know, releasing or not releasing information. So I think there's an awareness of confidentiality across the board. Working high profile is a little bit different. I mean, sometimes you need to arrange things in the office or see families at, you know, off time so that they're not running into other people in the waiting room. We have had high-profile clients where we have had kids all using aliases, and even all the paperwork, everything is under an alias until a kid actually is in a program, and at that point, it needs to come out. Otherwise, you're not going to be effectively treating. But we're able to really be careful and really watch to make sure all of this information doesn't become public for your kids as well as, you know, those of high-profile families.
Now, and you mentioned about the families referring them to you. I think another really dangerous point is the family that sends their child, who we'll call Johnny, off to XYZ program, and Johnny does great. You know, that family, you know, they hired all the right professionals. They got everything set. Johnny is doing great. Johnny gets back, and these parents then talk to the parents of Billy. And Billy's having problems. The parents go, wow, if Johnny did great there, we don't have to get any professionals. We don't have to do anything. We'll just send Billy to the same one. Can you explain to our listeners why that doesn't always work?
We see that happen a lot, not just with families, but also with mental health professionals, pediatricians who may have had patients go to a particular program and then all of a sudden they just start referring, you know, directly. The reason it doesn't work is the issues are different with kids, and what works for one child doesn't necessarily work for another. You're looking at how they learn, how they process information, what the underlying issues are. And different programs have different areas of expertise. They have different approaches. And you really want to be careful in terms of looking at what really appears to be the best match or which programs are the best match. And then what we do is we have parents visit. And one of the most frustrating parts of what I do is there are times when parents don't want to visit programs. And it makes it real difficult. They can talk with parent references. They can do all kinds of things. But nothing is the same as an in-person visit, especially being able to say to, you know, Johnny or Susie or whoever, you know what? We've been there.
Right.
We know what it's like. And they're able to really show that compassion and show that concern and show the child that, you know what, you're willing to take that time to go and do something, you know, and not just, you know, look at what the website shows.
Mm-hmm. Now, what are some examples of some of the differences? In other words, you know, if you have, again, you know, Johnny that did really, really well, but the program he went to was for low-functioning kids with chemical dependency as a primary issue. You know, now let's say that Billy is very high-functioning and chemical dependency is actually a secondary issue. Explain a little bit to the listeners kind of why that isn't going to work. There's a psychological reason why this will not be a good fit.
Right. Well, you want to look at really what's going on. You know, programs vary as well. You know, it's not just the child, but it's the program. They vary in terms of structure. They vary in terms of the types of therapy they offer. They vary in terms of how much chemical dependency support, if any, there is. And so one of the things that we want to look at is if you have, for example, a child that isn't as high functioning, if they're not as bright, if there's learning issues, and then you have a student that's really sharp, no learning issues at all, and may not be doing well academically because of everything else, the academic programs are going to be different. And you also need to have an appropriate peer group. So you get a really bright, manipulative, slick kid in with some of these more naive, less bright kids. You end up running into kind of what a lot of times you run into in school. You end up with bullying. You end up with kids being manipulated and taken advantage of, or a bright kid saying, oh, I don't belong here. You know, this isn't for me. This is a school for whatever kind of derogatory comment that they want to give. You also want to look at if a child doesn't need the substance abuse support. Well, you know what? Then you don't have, that's not going to be an important aspect of the program. If they're depressed, you want to make sure that you have psychiatrists that are there mm-hmm. that are really able to deal with medication if that looks like it's appropriate. So you really kind of have to look at everything. We talk about some kids need to be single sex. You don't want them in a co-ed program.
Sure.
So there's a lot of different things that we tend to look at as we're beginning to determine what's appropriate and what's not.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. In fact, I mean, with our company, I mean, we get asked by parents quite often for a referral to a program. For instance, if we've located their runaway teen, you know, or in some way the parent found us more through the investigative side. And they'll always say something like, well, wow, you know, we've checked you out. And since you've been doing this for 30 years, you must know all the programs and you must know which ones are good and which ones are bad and so on. Which one do you think would be best for our company? And I mean, and my staff are trained. You do not comment. You know, if they ask about a particular program, you still don't comment. If they go, well, okay, but if you don't want to just pick one for my child, what about, I went online and I saw XYZ program and I looked at their website. Now, can you tell me about that? No, we can't, because we don't know the child. But I think that's one of the things, as you said, where some of the people, you know, they might be in, you know, some other level of counseling. And I don't think that they, if they're not working with that child, how are they going to be able to make this determination? And in essence, you know, and I'll tell parents and I go, you know, I mean, It's like asking, you know, asking a podiatrist about brain surgery, you know, and they've not done any x-rays or CAT scans or MRIs or anything on that child's brain or on that person's brain, but yet they're going to ask the podiatrist, hey, what do you think we should do? You know, should we go to this particular, you know, place because we heard that they do brain surgery? Well, that doesn't mean it's the best place.
Right.
So, I mean, and what are some of the things that, you know, that you can, you know, what would you add to that answer? I mean,
well, I mean, we see that a lot. I mean, it's two things you need to know. One is, what is it that the child needs, and then you also have to really know the programs. And we talk a lot about, and especially if we use wilderness, for example, and I want to go into that in just a minute, but one of the things that we want to look at is what model of program do we want to look at? For example, there are programs that have very strong positive peer culture models, which is where it tends to be less authoritative. It's a lot more of kids working with kids and giving and receiving feedback. For some kids, a peer culture is incredibly important. For other kids, it's completely inappropriate. So you really have to be able to differentiate the programs in addition to differentiating the kids.
Mm-hmm. Well, and you mentioned about wilderness programs. I mean, tell our listeners a little bit about it, because I think that there are some myths out there of what wilderness is and what it isn't.
Yeah, there's a lot of myths. Boot camp. It's boot camp. It's like, no, it's not. It's not boot camp. Kids go to wilderness and they die. No, they don't. Wilderness can be an absolutely incredible experience. If money was not an issue, I would love to see any kid who needed it in wilderness, because wilderness does what no one, what other programs cannot do. Basically, if you're talking about therapeutic wilderness, kids are in small groups with therapists, with trained field staff, and they're very the staff and so forth, and the programs are very clinically savvy. So they're working with kids that are depressed, kids that are anxious, kids that are using drugs, kids that are angry and have anger management issues. It is soft, it is nurturing, and nothing does it better when it comes to teaching kids responsibility and accountability. Quit blaming everybody for what's going on, and, you know, let's begin to move forward. And we use wilderness probably for three different reasons. One is where we have not a clue about what's going on with the child. We know there's a lot of out-of-control behavior. So even if we were going to say, let's go to therapy, there's no way the parents have the control even to do that. Or some of these kids have been in therapy, but, you know, really don't use it. Either they sit there and don't say anything, or they fool around or tell the therapist what they want to hear. Right. So for whatever reason, we have no information. So to be able to talk about a long-term program is very, very difficult, because we don't even know where to begin. And I hesitate to put kids in ultra-restrictive programs strictly because of a lack of information. So if we're able to do wilderness, we can get a really good idea of what's driving the behavior. We can get testing done out in the field and get the child ready to move to that next step as we're getting that information. So sometimes we use it for that evaluative purpose. Other times we know what's going on. We have testing. We have a full idea of what's going on with the child. Clinically, they're in pretty good shape. We know what we want to do with them, but they're not ready to do it. And if we were going to move them, at that point, we'd have to do something really restrictive because they don't want to do it, and they're very resistant. The third time, or third reason we tend to use it, are for parents, because parents sometimes don't understand what the issues are with the child and why we need to be looking at something that's longer term. And there's so much parental work that's done with by the therapist with kids that are in wilderness, that it is absolutely incredible with how far parents are able to come.
Mm-hmm. And one of the questions actually that came in that was emailed into us, which is, you know, if you can discuss, obviously without names, you know, what is your greatest success story with a teen or a family?
Oh, wow.
Can you narrow it down to just one? I'm sure there's been plenty.
There's a lot. I mean, we love the follow-up. I think one of my favorite ones was, and this was years ago, this is probably 15, 20 years ago, and the family came in. In fact, I did something which I never do, which was actually go to the house, because they couldn't get the kid to come in. He wouldn't go to school. He wouldn't do anything. He was aggressive at home. I talked to the therapist. I talked to the school, the parents. No one could even say a nice thing about this kid. And that's incredibly rare. So we put him in a program, and he probably was there for almost 2 years, which wasn't that unusual that long ago. Did really, really well. He graduated high school. He went off to college. I got a phone call from him. He was married, and he had a baby, and just thanking me because he couldn't believe, you know, how he had come so far. And, you know, it's one of the ones that sticks out just because he was so horrid. And I don't say that about kids. He just so nasty. But we get success experiences all the time. We also have kids that leave programs and struggle. And we talk to parents about the fact that, you know, your child isn't going in Johnny, coming out Eddie. You're not looking for what we call like a personality ectomy. They're coming out, they're still kids, and they're going to make a lot of mistakes. And, you know, do kids go into these programs and never use drugs again? No. They use them. But hopefully they've developed a lot of those tools and those coping skills that they don't fall so far back down, they're able to really pick themselves back up. But most of them are going off to college, which is a huge question parents ask. You know, are they going to go to college? Are they going to go to college? There's no reason why not. Mm-hmm. But hopefully they're going to have a better success in college than had they not had treatment.
Absolutely. And I think also, I mean, if they're not so focused on college, do you run into the problem of the parent that's so focused on the fact that their child has to go to college? And the reality is that maybe that child's a trade school kind of kid.
Right. Or we look at it the other way. A lot of times families will use some of the college money to pay for programs. And we say, you know what, if the child doesn't get the help now, either A, they may not be alive to go to college, or just not be in condition because of just whether it's the mental illness or the behavior or the substance use.
Yeah. When you mentioned your success story, it's, again, one of many, it did remind me of one that I had, so I'd like to share it, but it's very similar to yours. And it's a call that I got on a Thanksgiving day. So as I was seated there with my extended family, so we had about 20 of us seated at the table, and as my phone buzzed, my family rolled their eyes because it was just, oh, here we go again, Alan, who gets calls during holidays and such because something's going on with the business. The beauty of it was so I stepped out of the room, and I took the call, and as I came back and sat down, everybody stared at me because I was teary-eyed. And, of course, they said, well, what's wrong? And I said, nothing's wrong. Everything is wonderful. I said, I just got a call from a boy who started the sentence by saying, you probably don't remember me, but, and he proceeded to say who he was. And I said, actually, I do remember you, and I remember you very well, even though it was 13 years ago.
Wow.
He said, I'm now 26 years old. I've got a good job. I'm married. My wife is pregnant with our first child, and I'm seated here for Thanksgiving with my extended family, and we're going around the table, and we're all talking about giving thanks. And as I was giving thanks, I felt the urge to call you. I mean, this was so heartwarming to me, and I told him that, well, first of all, the reason that I remembered him was because there wasn't many people that I located three times. he kept running away from the particular hospital that he was being placed in. The beauty of it was that, and he wanted the phone number of the other professionals that had worked with him. He said, as he was dialing numbers, mine was still good, but he wanted to get a hold of the other people because he wanted to thank everybody involved. And his words were, as I sit here with my wife and my extended family, I realize that other than my family who stuck with me, there were a few of you who, through your diligence in doing your job, is very instrumental to me even being able to be here based on his drugs and everything else. So that was the reason why when I came back to my Thanksgiving dinner, first of all, I felt wonderful, but also I was teary-eyed myself.
What a fabulous story.
Yeah. But I think, I mean, that's what keeps us in this business. Yeah. I mean, you know, to know that you are making a difference, you know, on the next generation, and I think is huge, which actually brings me to one of my questions, and that is, what do you enjoy most about your job? You know, where do you find the most fulfillment in it?
I think it carries on with what you just said, knowing that you're making a difference. People will say to me, you know, socially or friends, how can you do what you do? How can you send these kids away? And my first response is, you know, we're giving them a future. We're giving them a life. I wish we had a crystal ball to know exactly what was going to happen with all these kids, but we don't. But I believe that we are giving them a chance at a future. We're giving these families a chance to heal. And I keep in mind, these are the kids that are going to take care of us when we're old. So we got to get them on that straight and narrow, yeah. And just to push through, which if there's a common thread, I think, through every child that we see, regardless of socioeconomic level, regardless of family dynamics, there tends to be that level of entitlement and that the world owes them, and that lack of responsibility and the lack of accountability. And I have to keep in mind that, again, you and I, Alan, are seeing the same population. This is only a small percentage of all the kids that are out there. There are really, really good kids doing fabulous things. And that's also what keeps me going. To hope that a good proportion of the kids that you and I are seeing, that we can move over into that group that's just working more constructively. Because these are smart, great kids who are making lousy decisions, but
exactly.
They're really good kids.
Exactly. In fact, and there's, you know, myself also having done this for 30 years. In fact, I think we mentioned that. I mean, you're at almost 30 years as well. You know, because I'm flying to different states and stuff with many kids, I've had numerous times. We have the name of our company on our shirt, on a logo or of such, and I've had many people that sit down next to me, and they look at me, and they read my shirt, and they look over, and they see a teenager sitting next to me, and they've either seen something on TV about a boot camp, or they've heard something, and they go, I know you. I know what you do. You're that guy that takes those bad kids to those programs. And I'm sitting there with the child, and I turn to them, and I go, actually, no, I'm not. I'm that guy that takes good kids that have made bad decisions to programs that help. And it, oftentimes they kind of blush and sit back in their chair like, oh, I guess I sounded pretty stupid. But it's true. I mean, we're dealing with kids that in many cases are superior. They have superior intelligence. They're operating outside the bubble, which I think works well for us in this profession when we're working with them. If they've been told by someone else, a parent or someone, you know, that they are deficient or that they are somehow bad or something like that. And if that's what's being drilled into their head, I mean, it works to our advantage when we pick them up, because they'll go, oh, you're just like everybody else. You think that I'm fill in the blank. And I go, actually, I don't. In fact, you're probably of superior intelligence. You're just operating outside the bubble. But that's the beauty of the program you're going to or wherever it is that we're taking them, is they can help you deal with the rest of us.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but I think that changes their mindset to where they're now thinking a little bit differently of going, okay, this isn't a punishment. This is a growth opportunity.
And that they're not broken. They're not broken and someone's trying to fix them. And so often I think the you know, parents have all these expectations, spoken or unspoken, and these kids so often feel that they can't fulfill them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I get that sometimes. In fact, that's a good question for you. I mean, do you get that from the standpoint of siblings? You know, where you've got a parent that, you know, sibling number one, you know, was doing great, getting prepared to go off to major college and stuff, and sibling number two is struggling, you know. I mean, how does that interact in your ability to set that family up for success?
Well, we call them superstar siblings. And sometimes they're the older siblings. Sometimes it's the younger sibling. And we talk a lot about that. And for some of these kids, just how difficult it is. And getting parents to see that not all their kids are the same. You know, we find so often as we get kids going into programs that as soon as they get there, it's, well, now we got to go take our SATs. Now we have to go do all this. It's like, wait a minute.
Slow down.
Yeah, we really have to slow down. But, you know, the main thing is, and I think it's really important for the listeners, is that these are all of our kids. And again, they're really good kids. We're not talking about strictly adjudicated kids, and we're not talking about abused and neglected kids. And again, all of these kids are in need. But the clientele that we're working with, they're great kids. And if we can just kind of get them to see it and get them to believe in themselves and get them clean,
mm-hmm.
There's no stopping them with what they're going to be able to do.
Well, I just glanced over at the time, and I cannot believe it. We are just about out of time.
Very quickly.
I know. It's amazing. What I'd like to do is there one last point that you would like to make, you know, a 20-second point of what they can do?
Just really quickly, keep an eye on your kids. If they need treatment, get treatment. If you need a consultant, you can always go to the Independent Educational Consultants Association. It's IECAonline.com or .org. I just forgot the address.
And you know what? And I have some other stuff here.
But it's the Independent Educational Consultants Association, and you can get a list of all the consultant members in your area. That are all, you know, specially trained and ready to help you out if you need it.
Right. And if you have any other questions, you can go to www.answersforthefamily.com. Next week, listen in. Our guest is going to be personal health specialist and TV personality and author, Dr. Art Uhlein. Thank you, Terry, for being here.
Thank you so much.
We're out of here.
Bye-bye.
Listening to Answers for the Family with Alan Cardoza.
Alan Cardoza.
Only on LA Talk Radio. You're listening to the home of cool, irreverent, and entertaining talk right here on LA Talk Radio.
You want some in that night?